Welcome to Mailcore, the podcast where I, Laura, show my cool friend Panya the music that I like, which is mostly hard rock and heavy metal. Hello, good morning.
Hello.
How are you doing today?
I'm all sniffy, and I'm surrounded by cats who seem to want something but won't tell me what it is.
Tell them to use their words.
I don't know if that's a good idea. No. Talking cats is... In this household, that would be... It would never be quiet again.
Yeah.
They've had treats. They've had breakfast. They've had morning pets. I don't know what it is I think they want.
Okay. Are you ready for some marches of about death?
Marches.
Yeah, we're going to be marching towards the grave.
I mean, I'm a silly American girl, and marches make me think of dictators. Bad bits of history. Because if Americans do that kind of military display stuff, I don't know anything about it. And I grew up near a military base, too. So, of course, I might not have been paying attention.
Nah, they're going to be...
Let's see what doom metal marches sound like. Is this doom metal, death metal, black metal? What kind of metal are we talking about here?
Doom metal, yeah. We'll be listening to Candlemass from Sweden. They call them one of the big four of doom metal. So one of the other bands in the big four was Trouble. I haven't listened to Trouble much. Saint Vitus. I have more researching to do. I think I'll find some nice stuff.
Okay.
So Swedish boys, they come from the same suburb of Stockholm as the boys from the band Europe, a blessed place, apparently. Candlemass was formed in 1984, and the first album comes out in 1986. And they are so aware of the genre they want to be in that they call it Epicus Doomicus Metallicus.
I don't. That's not real Latin. That's not real Latin. What the hell? Why? Why would you do this?
You have to make spell words, right? And your own lore. It was done before J.K. Rowling. Epicus Doomicus Metallicus.
As far as I know, Rowling did not, in fact, invent any of those words. She did, in fact, use real Latin. That's not real Latin, you guys. It's great, but it's not Latin.
Yeah,
it's not Latin. Oh my goodness. So, anyway, we don't want to talk about her.
Mm-hmm. So, epic doom metal. People talk about stoner doom metal, which is very chill, and it's. I guess you enjoy it more if you are high. I've never chill, been high. I got bored on stoner doom.
Chill, but doom. Okay, I guess. Maybe. Mm-hmm.
And all of these bands are inspired by Black Sabbath. They've all worshipped the riffs that Tony Iommi played. So, let's go listen to Solitude from Epicus Doomicus Metallicus.
Okay, let's listen to Solitude. Made my whole spine tingle.
Oh, how?
The intervals between, I don't know the right words, but it was, okay, it's clearly not off key or anything, but there was something about it that my brain keeps saying off key, and that is the wrong word, because it's not. What is the word? I don't know the right word in music.
Dissonant?
Very frustrating. Yes, that's the word. Yes.
I made my whole can't, like, I can't recognize dissonance usually. I don't know.
It was dissonance used correctly. Like, that's what it's for. That's what it's for. Oh my god, my whole spine. Wow. Shut up.
No, I'm happy. Shut up. I'm happy.
You're laughing at me.
The doom has gotten to you. That's nice. That's very good.
Oh.
Hmm. So wow. One of the guitars was dissonant with the other, or?
No, the voices were dissonant to each other.
Ah, he wasn't harmonizing the way you usually expect it to.
Right.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Yes, exactly.
And he was very, for someone who's given up on life and sitting in the dark and just hoping to die, he was very emotional.
Yes.
Very expressive, his voice.
That's kind of how it is, actually. that there comes a point before you actually get to the point where you do something about it, where you're very emotional about it, or a lot of people are, where you're sort of angry that you're still alive. It's like, why? Everything sucks. Why am I still alive? This is not fair. Don't want this. And then you get to the point where you actually do something about it, or maybe you don't, and you get to the point where you've gone so far you can't do anything about it, and you're just stuck. Anyway. Yeah, I definitely do not recommend listening to that if you are, in fact, actually suicidal. Don't do that. Don't listen to that if you're having suicidal ideation.
Not this one. Sabbath, Bloody Sabbath, better, you say.
Yeah. But don't listen to that. It will yank you right over the edge. Do not do it.
Okay. You hear this, listeners. Don't do it.
Yeah. Be aware of where you are in your mind when you listen to certain things, and don't listen to things that are going to shove you over the edge.
So, a classic. They always play Solitude in shows. It's one of their biggest hits. And this album was recorded with a gentleman who left right after that. He wasn't going to join, but they really liked him, and so he came to record the album, at least, named Johan Lankvist. And they've had him for the past, I think, more than 5 years. He's back now. He joined in his late 50s. I think most of them have passed 60 at this time. So Candlemass had more than four singers. We are going to go, we're going to jump straight to 2016 now. I'm going to listen to another gentleman called Mats Levin. And
it seems like a lot of the older a band gets, especially bands that began in the 70s and 80s that are still playing, that their lineup has shifted a lot. Whereas if a band is newer, especially a band from the 2000s and later, if the lineup has shifted, then they give themselves a new name and they become a new band or something. I wonder what that's reflective of. It might be reflective of recording contracts, actually.
Maybe. What the record companies want.
The recording contract specifies that this band is these members, and that they won't publish music under that name. And so if they get different members, they have to get a different name.
Maybe. They had the bass player, Leif Edling. Did I say his name right? Yeah, Leif Edling. And he was always there, however many other people were changing. And they are currently back at the actual people who recorded Epicus Dumicus Metallicus, which I kind of love. So 2016, the singer Mats Levin.
Why did it skip so many years?
Because I've listened to Epicus Dumicus Metallicus, a little bit of the next album, and when I got into Candlemass, I got into the things from the 2010s. So I'm playing you my favorite things.
Okay. Okay, that's fine.
So that's this one's called Death Thy Lover.
Oh.
A very, very wise, wise song.
I introduced our meowsters to Mercedes Lackey some episodes ago, I think. Or maybe that one hasn't been released yet. Anyway, the point is, she also writes music. She writes folk music. And she has a song that is basically the same subject, about death as a lover, and I think that's amusing. Let's which album? This on 2016. Okay. to scroll around and find it. There it is. All right, let's listen to Death Thy Lover by Candlemass. No better. I'd say that was a Black Sabbath song.
Yeah. The way it's sped up.
It's clearly a different singer. It's clearly not Ronnie, but it's clearly not Dio. But other than that, if I didn't know better, if I heard that on the radio and was just listening, I would say, oh, that's Black Sabbath.
Yeah.
And there's not, it was very good. And it's kind of a love song. Mm-hmm. In a way. So I think that's why the dissonance that I heard in Solitude isn't there. That's not an appropriate kind of sound for a love song.
Yeah, in which you're feeling very comfortable with the death that you love.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't
yeah.
That discomfort isn't there.
I mean, it's obviously it's a doom metal. It's a heavy metal song, but it's a heavy metal love song.
Mm-hmm.
It is... So it's not a song to the lover, which I found interesting.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm scratching Buddy's head and he likes it so much. It's so good. Such airplane ears. Oh, Mom, it's so good. And then I booped his nose and he got offended.
You spoiled it. You spoiled the moment.
He's a spoiled kid.
My favorite bit of this one is when Death walks behind you with black halo thing. It's a black halo thing. We don't have to know what it is. It's okay. And he's also a superstar, Death.
Yes. You know, this makes me think of Terry Pratchett's Death, honestly.
May have been inspired, yeah.
And when he's at his most serious, when he is saving the world against the auditors, that kind of thing. I think of that because that is, you know, death turns up in a lot of books and a lot of places and a lot of stories, and these days most often death turns up in, you know, in horror movies and such, and it's frightening. And as a culture, we've very much gotten to the point where death is terrifying. It's why, at least in America, there are such lengths we go to prevent death, that people are on respirators and so forth. And it requires so many choices and so many decisions to let someone even in a coma go. We're terrified of death as a culture. That fear. And yet, this song and some other songs and Terry Pratchett's death remind me that it's part of a natural cycle. There are a number of books and tales that also invoke immortality and the idea of immortality and becoming immortal. But I've only actually found a very few books that truly address what would happen to society if people began to live for hundreds of years, how that would affect the way that we interact with each other, how that would affect the inheritance. I haven't found any books that address what happens if, or what might happen if more than just humans live such long periods of time, or if there was no such thing as death.
That's a disaster.
It's a mess, that's for sure.
I don't want to die, like I'm not trying to and not hoping for it, but it's in this culture that you described, it's nice to hear someone so peacefully telling me that death is always there for me.
Yeah.
It's always your only friend.
In English, we have a cliche, nothing is certain but death and taxes.
Yeah. Yeah. But not with, when he's watching over you, it's not with some sort of malevolence.
No,
maybe
it's not like
benevolent.
He's waiting for the moment. It's not like he's waiting for the moment to pounce.
Yeah,
he's not. He's just there. Mm. He's always there.
Hmm.
There's always this chance. There's always this possibility, and that's okay.
Hmm.
It's okay to live in a world where your safety, your longevity, is not absolute. It is not guaranteed.
And if you want certainty, here is some certainty. Death is certain.
Right. Eventually.
Okay.
Eventually. And it does remind me, I don't know that I talked about this much when I introduced Terry Pratchett to the Meowsters. I think I mentioned that he had early onset Alzheimer's and that he was promoting the option to he was promoting assisted suicide, actually. And to me, that links in with all of this, the idea that you don't have to wait for death. You can choose if you want to. And I'm not in any way advocating suicide in general.
Mm.
I do think that there are circumstances wherein your quality of life is so low that, and it takes so much effort to maintain what you have, that it's worth considering.
Mm-hmm. Life is no longer your friend. That's hard for other people to understand sometimes.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway. Is there a happier song on the list now that we've gotten all super doom?
No.
Okay.
We have a song about a great mythical octopus who will eat us one day. So that's a bit different.
Okay.
We have a ballad at the end. Very nice acoustic, but we're not gonna get happier.
Mm. Oh well,
you should have some chocolate.
Mm. Yeah, actually, everyone should have some chocolate. I have a chocolate and nut bar here that I'm slowly trying to eat.
Nice. Let's go listen to House of Doom from 2 years after that, 2016.
Okay. So let's listen to House of Doom.
Some sort of embassy to hell, because it's a bad place, the House of Doom.
When are we going to find that heavy metal musicians that don't care about the Christian mythos? Anyway.
Folk
let's
metal?
Listen to House of Doom.
Yeah,
all right. Let's listen to House of Doom by Candlemass, and I'll complain later. Just wanted me to keep playing the next song, and I'm going, yeah, wait. I'm on a podcast. I have to stop. Let me keep listening. You know, I realized one of the things that I quite like about this band, actually, is that they're not singing the whole time.
Mm-hmm.
So there's quite long periods in these songs where I can just listen to the guitars, and I like that. I don't feel like I have to spend any brain effort picking out the guitar sounds from the singer, which is nice. I like that.
Mm-hmm.
That. Yeah. Although this one had that, I'm familiar with songs that draw down at a certain point, and if you don't know the song, then you start applauding there or whatever, and you think it's over. This one did it right in the middle, which I think is very odd.
Mm-hmm. Remember this happening in the middle of Sleepwalking Past Hope.
That's true.
And then
that's true, but it's still not quite in the middle there. This one is almost exactly in the middle, which I thought was odd. Like in Sleepwalking Past Hope, in When You're Evil, in there's other songs that do it that I can't think of off the top of my head, but it usually comes in towards the last third of the song.
Mm-hmm.
And this one was right in the middle. It was much earlier than I expected it to be. And also, it was at a point that, at least in modern music, you'd think, okay, the song's been 3 minutes and a bit. That's a stopping point. You know, that's how long songs are. And then it goes on for another 3 minutes or so. And you're like, wait a minute. Wait a minute. What's going on here?
That may have been the point to cut it so early.
It may have been. I don't know. I quite liked it.
People are used to short things these days. Let's fool them. Let them think it's
legit. Although, looking at the length of the songs on that EP, on even the previous EP, these guys don't do shorter songs. A lot of their songs are 5 and 6 minutes long.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which I'm not complaining about at all.
Mm-hmm.
Going back to what I said after Solitude, I'm glad that you're introducing this to me, but I'm thinking that in the future, when I want to listen to this artist, I should probably not do it in the winter.
Mm.
I should probably not do it in the winter so that it doesn't trigger the seasonal affective disorder.
Mm. I'm going to keep an eye on you these days.
You should do that, actually. Mm-hmm. You should do that, Meowsters. If you have a good friend like Laura who offers to keep an eye on you during the periods of your day or your year where you know that things are harder for you, then let them. Let them take care of you. I know I absolutely am one of those people that I feel like other people taking care of me is me taking advantage of them. And I know that there are other people who feel that way. And we're wrong.
Yeah.
The fact is, when we feel that way, we're wrong.
You may have to suggest it to them then.
Yeah. And if they offer, let them do it. Mm. Let people care.
Yeah. I like the organ in this one and the inclusion of the bell.
Yeah.
I don't think Sabbath were that much into keyboard instruments of any kind until Heaven and Hell, where there was some doomy keyboards. So I'm glad that Candlemass have it and a few other doom bands have it.
Yeah.
Because it belongs. It absolutely belongs.
I like that. It's really great to listen to these heavy metal artists, and they have the dual guitars and they have the bass. But I like the inclusion of less common instruments. I like the inclusion of keyboards, of other things. I'm pretty sure in the first 10 seconds of that, before the guitars actually started screaming, I'm pretty sure I heard an actual person screaming.
Hmm.
Pretty sure I heard an actual person scream. Like, it was buried in the sound, but I'm pretty sure it wasn't a guitar. Pretty sure it was an actual person. And that is one of the things that I do actually really like about more modern music, in the sense of music made in the digital era, is I think a lot of musicians are finding it much easier to include these odd, interesting elements that give texture to the sound in a way that's very different from just playing a guitar, even with the kind of sound you can get out of an electric guitar.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I remember watching a stream that Rocky of the Driver Era was doing, and he mixes and balances their music. And he was talking about how in the beginning of one of their songs on the Girlfriend album, I think, if you listen very, very closely, you can hear the sound of rain.
Hmm.
That he just recorded off their back patio and included in the beginning of the mix.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the sort of thing I'm talking about that I love, that especially artists that do their own mixes, but even artists that have, you know, big names or whatever, they can include these other sounds and you don't realize that you're hearing that, but it gives a kind of texture. And I also like the part where when a group plays a song live, it doesn't have to sound like it sounds on the album.
Yeah.
It can be different. It can include different textural sounds or no textural sounds at all. It can be just the pure sounds of the guitars, insofar as, you know, electric guitars are pure with the distortion, but you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm. And then you go, even without all that decoration, though, what a nice song.
Yeah. That too, and just the idea that there's no such thing as a single definitive version of this thing that you've made.
Mm.
That it can shift and change as you play it, as you're in different parts of the world, as you get older, it can shift and you can choose to emphasize other elements.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
that kind of thing.
Yep.
So, yeah.
Okay. Let's go.
I do think the sort of music that maybe not in the winter, but at other times of year, I could turn on this music and write code. Because it has that kind of beat that for some reason helps keep me focused.
You mean the slower tempo?
Not really the slower tempo, but the intensity of the beat. Of the ability to feel it. And there's something about that kind of guitar and that kind of riff and that the kind of beat that we're hearing in House of Doom, in Death, even Death Thy Lover, that helps to keep me focused for some reason. It helps keep me... It doesn't make me feel, you know, oh God, I can't ever sleep. It's not like that, but it's, I guess it must work on me the way caffeine works on some people. I don't know. Caffeine doesn't work on me. I don't have a comparison.
I'm glad to hear it. So let's go. I'm glad I brought you a nice stimulant. Let's go listen to that great song that I love so much about the octopus, because I like kaijus, you know, big things.
You do like giant monsters. Have you seen Pacific Rim?
No, I think it's the next thing I should watch.
You definitely need, and I need to see Pacific Rim too. I still haven't seen that, but you need to see Pacific Rim because I think you will adore it.
Okay.
I think you will absolutely adore it.
All right. Pacific Rim is next.
Yeah, okay. So if you are a kaiju lover, if you like Gojira and Mothra and all of that, and you haven't seen Pacific Rim Meowsters, you should do. You should see it. You will enjoy it. Okay, but now we're going to go listen to what?
Astorilus the Great Octopus.
Oh.
This is a 2019 album, and we're going back to the original singer, Johan Lankvist.
Okay. Let's listen to Astorilus, the Great Octopus from the Door to Doom. Doom. That last bit, though.
They realize that as we come down from the excitement and the fear of this prophecy, we still need some company.
I was like crying. Whoa. Nice. Whoa. What world am I in? Where am I?
I don't know how he's the guardian of Nyx. Is he like a god dog? Or a bodyguard? There wasn't much detail.
Well, Nyx was the Greek, I think, goddess of night. So he's the guardian of night. I don't know. Maybe he likes Cerberus. I don't know. I got nothing.
Maybe.
Mythologies are weird.
There's a mountain of skulls at the Earthfall. And he will swallow us. So.
Yes. If he's an octopus, then he's in the ocean. And I'm betting there is a mountain of skulls down there. Woo! Davy Jones Locker. The Kraken. Wee wee, the Kraken! Sorry. I don't know what my brain just did.
As the song progressed and he was kind of yelling at the end, he will swallow us. It was like he was a prophet.
Yeah, I was thinking that. And it's the sort of prophecy that... not the prophecy itself. How do I put this? There's a trope in literature and movies in particular that, especially in that kind of semi-horror, like this is like Cthulhu myth, those type stuff. Mm-hmm. And there's always a prophet in those. There's always someone who knows what's coming, and they try to tell people and they're not believed, and over the course of the story they become increasingly crazed about it because no one is listening and people are continuing to do the things that will accelerate the problem. And that's kind of what it sounded like. Is that increasingly crazed prophet who is not being heard and knows what's coming and can't actually do anything about it without any help, but nobody's listening. Mm. Ah! And by the end of the story, they're just absolutely fucking insane.
But Johan also sounded like he was in awe. He didn't hate this octopus.
Well, yeah, that's also part of the trope, is that it's not necessarily terror, and it's not necessarily a prophecy that expects you to do something about it. Mm. But the increasing insanity of the prophet is not from approaching horror, or even the fact that the prophecy is approaching. It's the fact that no one's listening.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah. And this nice guitar solo that was very long.
Oh, I just kind of sat here and vibed.
Yeah.
Vibe.
That was Tony Iommi. He was a guest on this song.
Oh, no wonder it sounded so familiar and lovely.
Mm-hmm. And the big difference, because he uses different strings because of the two fingertips that he lost.
Uh-huh.
And he has his very distinct sound. And it sounded very crisp, almost keyboard-like at the start, and then it changed in the other parts. That was great. It was great news for me, because I had just discovered Candlemass and this album came out, and it was like a gift.
Oh, yeah.
Doom Christmas.
Doom Christmas. I mean, that's kind of how you felt about a year ago, except it wasn't Doom Christmas, it was Love Metal Christmas.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yep. Yep.
Now, let's go to a German festival in...
Okay.
It can't be 2017. I got something wrong.
2019.
Yeah, okay. So we'll get...
It says 2019 and listen to them play it live?
Yeah. So we'll be in the first row. Let's watch a story list at the Bang Your Head Festival.
Oh, front row. Shiny. All right, let's watch the story list, The Great Octopus, live by Candlemass. Oh, I managed to pause the video where it looks like one of the guitarists is just hanging in the air.
What the hell? Oh, no.
What the hell? Anyway.
Levitation. That was very epicus, right?
Yes, yes. There's a particular smile I get when I'm watching a musician live or a group of musicians, and I can feel their camaraderie, I can feel their joy in the music, I can feel their connection in the audience.
Mm.
And I can get that out of videos too. And I think I had that smile all the way through this video, because it was just
I'm glad I found it, because they don't have an official DVD or a professionally shot show with Johan from the latest years, so this was nice.
It's pretty good. The videographer is pretty good. And I'm enormously entertained by the performing, not just the singing, but the performing and the actions and all of it. It's really good.
Okay. Now, we're gonna walk a bridge to death, or to the afterlife. We don't know. The song is called Bridge of the Blind.
Oh, are we blind because somebody put our eyes out, or are we blind because we don't know what's on the other side?
Definitely the latter, but maybe the first one too.
Might be that dark. We might not know because it's dark and we can't see.
Mm. But it sounds like it's a bridge to whatever is after death.
I don't want to know. Don't want to know what's after death. Okay. As our final step down Doom Music Lane, we'll listen to Bridge of the Blind by Candlemass. That is the song of a person whose love has gone before them.
Yeah. They have this one person that they're thinking about as they die.
Yeah. Yeah. It would not surprise me in the least to find out that that song was inspired by being present at or knowing of the death of a grandparent or something whose significant other had gone before them not long before. And that the grandparents' relationship had been 50, 60 years. I think that's actually, in a way, what happened to my grandfather. Died of Alzheimer's, basically. She forgot to eat. Even though she was in a memory care home, she kind of ended up starving herself to death. But the person that she was when she died was not in any way the person that I grew up with.
Yeah.
That person had died before. But my grandfather only lived another year or so after she died. And I do believe his death was hastened by her absence.
Yeah. These things are fascinating and a bit scary and understandable.
A little bit. I don't know. We talk about, especially these days, we talk about codependence and this and that. And all I can think of when I hear people talk about that in relationships is that turning the ideas behind the word codependence into something negative is a good way to teach people not to actually have partnerships with their loved ones.
I hear codependence from mental health professionals usually.
Yes, and that's part of why
in unhealthy relationships.
That's part of why it worries me, because it's a word and a concept that is very, what's the word I want? It's very easy to have that tip one way or the other. And I guarantee you that there are people who would look at my relationship with my husband and the way that we pick each other up and the way that we remind each other of things and the way that we take care of each other and say, oh, you're codependent. That's bad. And I would look them dead in the eye and laugh in their face and walk away.
Was this a word before mental health professionals started using it about abusive relationships? Was it a positive word?
I genuinely don't know. I would have to do quite a bit of research on that.
But you mean having such a kind of interwoven way of life and partnership with someone, you wouldn't want this to be shown in a negative light?
I think it can be either, and I think the negative light of it gets overemphasized. I very much think it gets overemphasized. Could I live without him? Yes. Would my quality of life be as good? Absolutely not. My life would not be nearly as good without my husband in it, because of the way that we take care of each other. But there are people who would look at that interwovenness and say, well, you can't live by yourself and that's bad. Oh, I could. It just wouldn't be very good. It wouldn't be nearly as good. And I think that's an important distinction to make. But at any rate, Bridge of the Blind is clearly a song being sung by someone who had a long and very good relationship with someone, and that person went on before them, and now they too are dying, and they're not sure what they're going to find on the other side, because you can't know.
And I guess they're feeling blind because they can't see what they're leaving behind, even that maybe that's why.
Well, he does say in some of the last lyrics, if I open my eyes, it implies his eyes are closed. We were discussing before we listened to the song, you know, why are they blind? And now I think it's not, oh, they don't know. And it's not, oh, it's black. It's, they've chosen to close their eyes and walk forward into the unknown.
So that life wouldn't tempt them, I guess.
I don't know.
So they wouldn't feel sad as they go.
Yeah, maybe so.
I always perceived this as when I opened my eyes, and I thought on the other side, but it is if I open my eyes. So he did close them, he decided.
It almost evokes, Orpheus. It almost invokes the myth of Orpheus.
Because he wasn't supposed
to look. Yeah, he wasn't supposed to look back. And so it almost evokes that. The idea that looking back will cause you to lose something that you were trying to get, you know. Although it does make me wonder, you know, in that myth, like obviously in the myth, Orpheus looks back. But what would have happened if he had his eyes closed but turned his head? Like, is it nuanced enough for that? Good question.
Don't know. And in this one, I wonder why he says no sign of summer on the other side.
Oh, that one I know, actually. In mythologies other than the Christian and other than the Jewish, the afterlife is often described as a summer land. And some of this, it's a bit more prominent in Nordic mythologies that don't bring up Valhalla. And I think it has something to do with the fact that winter and the cold season were such a struggle. And so you didn't grow things and you had to rely on what you had. And so the afterlife, the appeal of the afterlife would be, this is a land where I'm not cold. This is a land where I can grow anything I need, where I'm not hungry. Because summer was a period of time where it was easy to fulfill one's daily needs.
Yeah.
I want to say that there were also some Greek afterlives that evoked summer, but I'm not as certain of that.
Mm-hmm. So I've missed that aspect.
Yeah. That actually jumped out at me when I heard him sing no sign of summer on the other side. And I went, oh, he's referencing the Summerlands. I know this mythology. But that also...
But he's not looking. Is he feeling cold as he crosses the bridge?
Or
is he not hearing birds?
Or he's not smelling or feeling the warmth. You know, there are a lot of elements to the way that we sense and detect things that don't rely on sight at all. Just as a species... so heavily reliant on sight, which is kind of funny. We've decided that his eyes are closed, but I do think also that there's probably an element of passing through a barrier. And so, even if there was Summerland on the other side, you might not know, because that barrier is there and it blocks anything. It blocks you from knowing what's on the other side. So you might as well walk into it with your eyes closed. You can't tell anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, so that was Candlemas.
And when we were listening to Solitude, I was on YouTube, and there was the top comment was, "I feel like I'm walking. I'm going to my own funeral."
Yeah.
So that was fun.
marching to my own funeral.
Thank you for sharing the doom metal with me.
I don't want to say this is good doom metal, because I feel like that's an odd way to put it. In a technical sense, this was very good doom metal. And in the sense of the emotions that it invokes, I'm not as certain. This is definitely a band I'm going to have to be careful with.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes you just want to listen to some music that tells you that there are other people who feel the same as you.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, if you're dealing with the death of someone that you cared about, I could see this being pretty good music to listen to all along. that the idea of death as a lover, the idea of being taken care of by death, the idea of not knowing what's on the other side. I could see that being very comforting. And there's absolutely a reason that dirges and mourning songs have been a thing throughout human history.
There's a use in them. It's good for people to sing in those times.
It's good to allow yourself to express that grief, to not bottle it up inside, to not... There's a platitude that I hear most often from people who have been steeped in Christianity that, oh, they've gone to a better place. Don't tell me that. Don't tell me that when in the first week, in the first month after someone I care for has died. Don't tell me that. I don't want to pretend that it's better for them and use that as an excuse not to grieve or not to allow myself to grieve. Okay, maybe it is better for them, but for me, I miss them. They're gone and I hurt. Mm-hmm. I don't need to pretend that I'm not in pain because of that. You know, it's like, and it's not that that's not a thing that should be said. When Michael's mother died, she had been in a coma for, I don't know, 3 or 4 days. We finally turned off the machines. And she had been in pain and struggling, not just mentally, but physically, for the better part of 6 months before that. And so to say she's in a better place at that time, there was a comfort in that, in the idea that she was no longer in pain. But saying that as a means to say that you shouldn't grieve is bad, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
yeah, you definitely shouldn't be telling people how to feel and what not to feel.
Yeah, like, I was glad that she was no longer hurting. I was. But I missed her. There was an absence there that, I don't want to say it shouldn't be there because that's not correct either, but there was an absence and it was raw and it needed time to heal. And it was much worse for Michael than it was for me, his mother. And that's, I don't know how true this is for your culture or European culture, but American culture really teaches men not to grieve.
Mm-hmm. And you have to be tough. Awful. And the only permissible emotion is anger, which makes you pretty dangerous.
Yeah, and he wasn't angry about it. Even now, I think... In some ways, Michael is still grieving the loss of his parents in ways that I can't see because he's been taught not to show it. It's been, I don't know, six and a half years since his mother passed and 3 or 4 since his father passed. And I think in a way he's still grieving that because he was taught not to show it. And see, he was never allowed.
It slows down the healing, you say.
Yes, it was. He never permitted himself to be open about it. And so the moments in which he could actually grieve have been few and far between. And it takes that much longer to assemble enough moments. I don't know where I was going with that.
Enough moments in which you allowed yourself to be sad.
Yeah.
And face reality. Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, now we've been, wow, really doomy and gloomy and oof. Oof. So, on the plus side, Katz is crazy.
What's the Katz doing?
I mean, right now, Mirari is making me a paw bouquet. So we have a kitty tree that has a columnar box at the top with a round hole in it, and that's their nest. And she likes to sleep in it in such a round way that all 4 of her feet are sticking out and clustered together.
Oh,
and her little chin sticking out. And I call that a paw bouquet. And if I were to get up and try to touch her toes, she would take them all away. But right now she's dead asleep, and I don't think she's even aware that I'm looking at her. And there's this, oh, she moved. Oh, stretchy toes. Oh, they're so stretchy. Oh, she's still asleep. Buddy is curled up on top of the nest with all his toes together. And last weekend, we were at a friend's place, and they were... the cat delivery system delivered them two kittens, but they have decided not to keep the kittens. But they haven't placed the kittens yet. So they're about 4 months old with all of the absolute insanity that that brings. and so we watched these two kittens amuse themselves with each other and with us. And for all that these kittens apparently came in from the wild, they don't appear to be feral in any way, which is, again, the cat distribution system, interestingly, often distributes cats who have been thrown out of previous homes, other homes. I've talked before about how Kronos and Stormlight came to us, and that's effectively what happened to them. And I'm pretty sure that's what happened to these two kittens.
So they're not afraid of humans?
They are not in the least afraid of humans. It, you touch them, and you pick them up, and... like, kitten body go... just instant purring. Really, like, how does something that small make that much noise? Yeah, how does something that small just that much noise? And if you get both of them at once, it's like your whole body just starts to vibrate. Like, that's when I can really believe that cat purr, the frequency of cat purr, is good for your health. Because, wow, they just vibrate. And they have this habit. They named them, one of them is a sable kind of black fluffy thing, and her use name is Coco. And the other one is a sort of a black and white cow pattern girl with a black chin. And so they call her name, her use name is Crazy Cow, but it comes out Cece. And they have, the two of them have this tendency that one of them is asleep and the other one is going to come and harass her sister.
No.
I'm going to come and lie down beside you and put my paws around your neck and try to chew your ear off. And they have three older cats in their house, which also came via the cat distribution system. Some 5 or 6 years ago, and the kittens are desperately trying to befriend these older cats, and these older cats are not sure how they feel about this. Flynn will be lying on their cat tree, and Coco will get up on another level and reach down her paw to try to bat at his head. Poor life choices there, Coco. Poor life choices there, and Flynn is like, what are you doing? What are you doing? Go away! And he'll reach up and whop at her. In our old house, when Kronos and Stormlight had first come to us, well, not, but some 3 or 4 months later, Kronos was trying to pester Helios. And Helios was always, he was the ragdoll cat I had first before Mirari. And he was the most laid back cat. He was very friendly. He loved to play. He was very chill. He didn't get angry. I think in his entire 10 years of life, I think I heard him hiss maybe 4 times. And one of them was at my mother, of all things. I don't know. But Kronos was trying to play with his tail. And after a couple of minutes of that, Helios turned around and smacked him with a paw. Like, didn't hiss or anything. Clearly wasn't really angry. Just stopped that. And Kronos just did the somersault to the end of the bed because he'd been whacked so hard.
But from fright or just from the force of the
whack? Just from the force.
Wow.
Just from the force of the whack. Helios just smacked his ass. He did a somersault to the end of the bed. And that's kind of how Coco and Cece are, that they're gonna keep bothering Molly and Flynn until they get smacked, and then they'll go away for a while and chase each other.
They don't know how to do this stuff.
They don't know well, and there's a difference in the way that kittens behave and older cats behave when they've literally grown up together and the older cats have seen the kittens being born versus when you add new kittens to a household with older cats. And it's not that you can't do it. but some of it is dependent on the personalities of the various cats, and some of it is dependent on the way that you introduce them to each other. And one of the reasons that Buddy is called Buddy, honestly, is because he wants to be friends with everybody. When we brought Mirari home as a kitten, like, the thing you're supposed to do is have the kitten in one room with the door closed and they have everything they need in there. And you're supposed to do that for a week or so and have maybe supervised playtime with the other cats in the house. And they get used to each other's smell and they get used to each other's presence. Buddy was not having any of that. We took Mirari into the library and set her up and tried to keep Buddy out. And he just squirted himself in through the hole because cats are liquid and went right over to her. And they swapped nose sniffs and she tilted her head at him, which was really cute because she was the size of a bean. And then he just went and flopped over by the window. And that was it. Like, that was it. We still wouldn't let him stay in there unsupervised. And in general, when we did this with both Mirari and Jana, their first week in the house, they would stay in the library unless we were having actual proper supervised playtime. And I would be in there with them, with a laptop to work, whatever. So that the kittens weren't alone in there except at night when we went to bed. And then after that, they'd be allowed to ramble around the house of their own free will during the day when someone was home and get used to moving around the house and then be in the library at night for a week. And then after that, they were free to roam, you know, and very small kittens between 6 weeks and say 4 months or so, I tend to keep a closer eye on because they'll try to do things they can't do. They'll try to jump to things they can't reach. And, you know, they're not even tall enough to climb the stairs properly. And this is a house with stairs. So I would keep a bit of a closer eye on them. They'll do things like go all the way up a 7-foot cat tree and then jump off the top ledge.
Oh, no.
Yeah. I'm looking at you, Mirari. She's ignoring me. Sleep. Jana did that, but with a shorter tree, and she fell off because she was trying to get onto the fireplace mantle and missed. And while it is true that cats do almost always land on their feet, there's an almighty thump when a kitten fucks up a landing. Even if they land on their feet, there's an almighty thump when they land from more than about 3 feet up. And I'm always a little bit worried that their growing bones can't take it. But so far we have not had, I've never in all my life, never actually seen a cat be hurt from falling like that. But I'm always a little worried, you know, when they make those, I'm going to stand on Papa's shoulder and Papa is 6 feet tall and then I'm going to jump off all the way to the floor. And there's this thump of a kitten who weighs maybe 5 pounds.
Yeah, the head can be bonked. You can get a concussion.
I don't know what a kitten concussion would look like. Honestly, I don't think I want to find out. But yeah, don't take Buddy as an example of how older cats will treat kittens that they're introduced to, because Buddy is pretty much unique in that regard. I mean, when I was growing up, my sister and I were each allowed to adopt a cat. And my mom had this idea that girl cats should be allowed to have one litter before you got them fixed. And my sister's cat was the girl. And so she had a litter of kittens. And Curious, who was her brother, was just fine with the kittens because he'd known them literally from the moment they were born. So as far as he was concerned, they were part of his clowder from the beginning. He didn't have to be introduced to them. Whereas if you're introducing kittens who are already part grown, and even then, it's not always a guarantee. Like when Stormlight came to us, her kittens were, I think I said, maybe a week old. But Helios was still of the opinion that he was not sure what was going on. Like that was one of the other times I ever heard him hiss. We had them in the garage, and he came out and sat on the steps into the house and looked around at these kittens and the smell in the air and Stormlight, and just sort of impartially distributed a hiss through the whole garage and then went back inside. Like, I don't know what's going on here, and I don't really think I like it, so I'm going to tell the world. And then after that, he was fine. You know, and we did the supervised visits and that when we added the Stormlight and Kronos and Doc to the household. But during that early period, even though they were still very tiny kittens, his opinion was that he didn't approve of this. He had not agreed to this, and it was not okay. And I think Stormlight, in a way, is still kind of that opinion about Janna, but I think that a lot of that has to do with the fact that Janna is very... Janna is... She may be 18 months old, but she still acts like she's about 4 months. She wants to play, she wants to bounce, she wants to run and jump, and Stormlight is old and cranky and doesn't want anything to do with other cats.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's as much a personality conflict as anything else. Yeah, if you're having trouble with Doom, I recommend, if you don't like cats, go find some puppies. Puppies are good.
Yeah. To bring you back up.
Yeah, to bring you some joy. Go visit a humane society, something like that. And play with some animals. And they will love you.
Yeah, that sounds like nice mental health care.
In the last, I don't know, decade or so, I've noticed, especially at finals time, colleges will advertise, I guess, to their students that they have dogs and cats, puppies and kittens to come and relax with. You know, it is truly considered a form of stress relief, that if you're stressing out over finals, come hang out with the dogs and cats for an hour or so, you'll feel better. You know, come study with the cats, that kind of thing.
Why don't they make the finals less stressful for people and teach them better? So
That's a complex thing. Even for me, who has very little trouble learning things and does a lot of self-teaching, the idea of being tested on it, essentially being criticized on it, is difficult. Even though I know the things, I'm still stressed. So it's not always a question of, oh, the final is too hard, or, oh, they didn't teach us. It's a question of how your brain chooses to handle it. And there are a lot of people I know who are quite smart, who pick things up very, very well, and they still have test anxiety. It's something inherent to the idea of being quizzed on it. And I honestly don't know that there is any other way to find out, did you learn the thing? Do you know the thing? How else can you find that out in a way that's not stressful? And I don't think there is one.
Yeah. Okay. Because I've always kind of enjoyed tests and exams, but I think I'm pretty rare.
I think you are pretty rare. I usually just wanted to get them over with. And for me, the stress tended to fall as much after as before. Because frequently I would be the first person to finish the exam, to finish the test, and I would turn it in, and the teacher would look at me and say, are you sure? Don't you want to check your answers? I've done that. Okay. You know, and then of course my classmates would also give me funny looks for being finished so quickly. That kind of thing. And that's not always a comfortable place to be in. And even if you've spent a significant chunk of the previous semester or whatever kind of trying to conceal your knowledge, once you get to the exam, if you turn it in first, well, there went your concealment. Your concealment just went, it's gone.
Oh, that's stressful.
Yeah, and that's kind of stressful. But, yeah. On the other hand, I think that it's better in the long run, not in the short run, it's stressful, but in the long run, it's better to not try to hide that you know things, that you can know things. And there is a fine line there between bragging about it, I know this thing, mm-hmm. I don't, or something, and simply being aware that you know the thing, that you can do the thing. There is a fine line there, and there are tons of people who will take the mere existence of your knowledge as you bragging. And that really sucks. Okay, I've been
because
there.
Because of what's happening in their own heads.
Yeah, that really sucks. But as you get older, as you meet more people, you will find people for whom that's not the case. You will find people that what they really want to do is exactly what we're doing here on the podcast. They want to bring you the things that they know, the way that Laura brings me the music, and exchange them for the things that they know, the way that I bring an author. That's what they want, is you know different things, and you exchange them, and you get excited about what the other one knows, and you learn new things off of the synergies of that. And there will be, as you meet more people, there will be, as I have found, people who will say, I know you know this thing. Can you help me? Will you teach me?
Mm-hmm.
And that's also, I've found that to be very gratifying, to have people come to me and say, I've seen that you know this thing. I've seen that you're good at this thing. Maybe you don't know exactly what I want, but we can find out together.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah, that's how it should be.
Yep. It's how it should be. And there are people out there like that. You just, sometimes you just have to wait, and the waiting is hard.
Mm-hmm. But keep that perspective in mind.
Yep.
Keep that hope. Yep.
Keep that in mind.
And who's the author this week?
So the author this week is Jim Butcher. And while Jim Butcher is probably best known for his Dresden Files series about a wizard named Harry Dresden for hire in essentially modern Chicago, it's been a long time since I've read any of the Dresden File books, and I think I'm about 6 books behind at this point. And as much as I enjoyed the Dresden Files when I read them, Harry is a smart aleck. He has a talking skull named Bob, who is also a smart aleck. Mm-hmm. It is a fantastic world space with an interesting perspective on the way that mythologies are integrated into the real world. Harry deals with vampires. He deals with the fey courts. He deals with fucking dinosaurs brought back to life and werewolves and I think some yeti and the Archangel Michael and like all kinds of all the mythologies are real kind of thing. And he deals with all of that, and it is very much the sort of tale where it looks like it starts off small with Harry dealing with, you know, seemingly small things in Chicago, magical related disappearances, that kind of thing. He starts off as a cross between Gandalf, only not that old, and Sherlock Holmes, honestly. He's an investigative wizard. And then he just gets drawn into bigger and bigger and bigger stuff. And the truth is, even at the beginning, you are told that Harry has quite a bit of power for a wizard. He is not weak. He keeps a fireball spell, I think, in a ring. I don't remember exactly how he keeps it. It's been too long. But he keeps a fireball spell prepared at all times and is not hesitant to use it. Which I always kind of enjoyed. That his answer to certain magical things was to just set it on fire. I don't have time for finicky stuff. I'm going to just set it on fire. You know.
Is it effective?
Some of the time. Some of the time. I believe in the climax of one of the books, 4 or 5 down, I think, he rides a Tyrannosaurus Rex skeleton into battle. I forget why, but yeah. Like, it's great. It's great. It's and he has a lot of interesting relationships, and he has a police person essentially on call because they do have a small unit that is specifically tasked to deal with magical stuff that the rest of the department does not want to know about. This is a world space in which, so there's a trope in urban fantasy that's referred to as the masquerade. And it's so the masquerade is how aware is the general run of humanity of these magical things. And in some cases, the magical people, the vampires and the people with magic and such, really try hard to conceal. They try to blend. And in other cases, there's no masquerade at all. In Harry Dresden's world, there's a 75% masquerade, I guess. The general run of people doesn't really know about these things because they don't affect them. In the same way that, you know, we don't know about the daily lives of people in Korea. That kind of, it doesn't affect us, so we don't know. That kind of thing. But there are times and places and spaces where the mundane, the mystical intrudes pretty heavily into the mundane. And so there are people in government and there are units in police departments that are specifically tasked to interface with the magical community, especially the humans that form the true interface layer between vampires and fairies and the general run of humanity.
But how are they keeping the status quo? Is it like they make people forget, like in Men in Black?
It depends on the book. It depends on the writer. I don't remember what happens in the Dresden Files. As I recall, most of the time, they don't need to make people forget. As I believe there's at least one circumstance in the Dresden Files where somebody gets sucked sideways into magical events, and well, that's it. You know now, that's the way it is. And so, you know, in some cases it is, in some world spaces it is, like Men in Black, where there's an active masquerade. In many of the cases, though, it's not so much an active masquerade on the part of trying to make people forget, so much as the majority of the mystical beings make an effort not to stand out.
Mm-hmm.
That they, that, you know, yes, vampires will go and hunt for people to eat, but they don't stand in the middle of a city square and scream, "Give me blood," kind of thing, you know. And when you think about the modern world and the kind of subcultures and weirdnesses and things that we have, a vampire in particular would not have trouble finding people to bite. There are vampire fetishists out there in our world, and I don't actually think there are really vampires, but if there were, they could go find those vampire fetishists and that would be fine. And these would be people who already believed that they existed. So it's not like they're breaking the masquerade.
Mm-hmm.
You know? That's how it tends to be handled in a lot of the books. Is there's no need to actively keep the masquerade. It kind of keeps itself because of the way that, especially in urban fantasy, because of the way people are.
But I'm thinking of people these days as people who are constantly on the internet and very curious.
And there are, but there are a lot of people who are constantly on the internet and still not curious. And there are a ton of people who are constantly on the internet and would look at a TikTok going, "I found a vampire," and roll their eyes.
Mm-hmm.
You know? Or they would, a TikTok or a Facebook page about meeting a vampire would go viral and people would think that it was some kind of augmented reality game, or they would say it was photoshopped, or all kinds of things. People have a tendency to, and this is something that's actually discussed in some of these books, people have a tendency to do things in their head that makes it so these things they don't believe in don't exist anyway.
Yeah,
you know, bias. There are a lot of people out there who would be confronted with something explicitly magical, in fact, and over the next few months, they would rearrange the memories in their head so that it wasn't.
Yeah,
and that's
I don't need to worry
directly.
That much about the masquerade, I guess.
Yeah, and that would be people who were directly confronted with it. People who saw stuff on the internet, that's easy to dismiss. That is incredibly easy to dismiss and is one of the reasons why there's such a thing as conspiracy theories. And why there are people who will claim about other people, I wouldn't believe you told me the sky was blue until I went out and checked it myself. It's that kind of thing. You know, the masquerade keeps itself.
Okay.
However, as much fun as the Dresden Files can be, I actually enjoy Butcher's Codex Alera much, much more. The Codex Alera is actually only a 6-book series, whereas the Dresden Files is still ongoing. If I understand correctly, it came out of a bet. Somebody bet Jim Butcher, and I think it might have been online actually, that he couldn't take 3 random concepts and make an interesting story out of them.
Oh.
And, well, with a writer as skilled as Jim Butcher, that was a mistake. That was a mistake.
What were the concepts?
The Lost Roman Legion and Pokemon.
That's 2.
Yeah.
And the third one?
I don't remember. The third one, I can't find it. Supposedly there was a third one, but I don't know what it was. But the story basically is... we're in a world, a different, explicitly a different world to which humans are not native. And there are 2 or 3 other alien races who also don't appear to be native to this world. And the humans are supposedly, it's never explicitly confirmed, but supposedly descended from the Lost Roman Legion. I forget which legion it was.
Legio 9 Hispana.
Yeah. Who apparently just vanished at one point. And so the theory, as developed by readers outside of the books, is that they marched into a portal into this other world and very confused and very lost, they sat down and decided to be really freaking Roman. Which meant that they established an empire. And they still fight in essentially the same Roman manner. That kind of thing. But they happened to stumble into a world where there are kinds of nature spirits known as furies. And there are 6 types of furies, I think. Generally based on the classical elements with the addition of metal and wood as well. And it's not so much that they're nature spirits in a general kind of way, they're nature spirits in a specific kind of way, as in literally there can be an individual spirit that you can bond to. So it you're capturing or connecting with monsters or beings a la Pokemon. That's exactly the way it is, that you have these and they will name them. More powerful people have multiple spirits or more powerful spirits. In the climax of one of the books, there is in fact a spirit of a volcano that someone tries to bind.
Wow. Did he evolve too, like the Pokemons?
Not really. It's definitely not in exactly the same way as the Pokemon. I think there are a couple of points in the story where it is implied that they can become stronger, that the Furies can become stronger, but they don't change shape in that way, and they don't have specific attacks in that way. Although, obviously, you can't make a water fury throw fireballs. Not in its nature. However, you can use a water fury to, say, freeze all the water in someone's body. And they have some more esoteric kinds of associations. Those who bond with water furies and have a water affinity are capable of sensing other people's emotions and sometimes manipulating them. Water is used to heal. Those who bond with earth furies are said to be persistently stubborn. It is possible to bond more than one type of fury. That kind of thing. There is said to be a fury who represents, a great fury, in fact, who represents the spirit of the whole continent. That kind of thing. Oh, that was the third one. The third one was the Zerg. The third concept was the Zerg.
What is that?
So the Zerg are a race out of the Blizzard game StarCraft.
Oh.
And they evoke that old trope of bugs or nanobots that take over the world by endlessly multiplying, and they're impossible to communicate with, and they evolve quite quickly to handle whatever you throw at them. And so you have this empire descended from the lost Roman Legion who have bonded Pokemon nature spirits facing off against an alien race of bug creatures who evolve and want to take over the everything. Wow. And it's not even so much that they want to take over the everything in a possessive kind of sense as it is a we must grow and multiply. Nature out of control kind of thing. Unfortunately, our very young main character, I think he's all of like 14 at the beginning of the first book. He's quite young. He is kind of accidentally dared to go into one of the spaces where the aliens are hibernating. For various reasons, and some of his blood gets dripped into the cocoon of a queen. Makes the queen smart. Or at least smarter. And so throughout the course of six books, she is increasingly more powerful and increasingly more threatening, and so's our hero. This one I'm specifically not going to spoil for people, but he learns some trope things about himself that make him more than a match for her and result in quite the climactic showdown in the last book. There is the usual semi-political intrigue. There's romance. There are lesser enemies than our alien queen. I think there are five different alien species, including humans, who are involved over the course of the story, and the ways that they interact with each other become relevant. They become relevant to the course of the story.
What do the Romans say when they see aliens? Do they think they are some form of mythological creature at first?
Because the time of the story is some thousand years after the Lost Roman Legion comes to Alara, we don't know. By the time the story begins, these non-human creatures are familiar. They are known quantities. We don't know. We don't actually have a written experience of any Alaran encountering a creature they don't know. So we don't know. I would be very interested if Jim were to go back to this world space, but I don't know that he will. He's pretty focused still on the Dresden Files, which is still going. And he's just released the second book of a steampunk series called The Cinder Spires. Finally. It took almost a decade for the next book of The Cinder Spires to come out. It's honestly been kind of frustrating.
Banya wanted it.
She did! She wanted to know what was going to happen next! But it's been I read the Aeronauts One list when it came out, and I have no memory of what happened. But according to Butcher himself, in describing the Cinder Spire series, it's League of Extraordinary Gentlemen meets Sherlock meets Hornblower. There are goggles and airships and steam power and bizarre crystal technologies and talking cats who are hard little bullies. So I may have to go back and reread them now that the Olympian Affair has come out. And I reread the Codex Alera every 2 or 3 years just because it's that good to watch. I just enjoy watching this character grow and evolve, and the things that he deals with and the things that he confronts are so properly embedded in the world. And there are genuinely only a very few characters in the Codex Alera that one cannot feel sympathy for. By the end of the 6-book series, it's possible to feel sympathy even for the Alien Queen. As you move through the story and you learn more about them. And I feel that kind of element in a story, in characterization, is the mark of a really skilled writer. The ability to make you, or to allow you, to sympathize even with the villains. Even as you're cheering for the heroes.
She's smarter than the rest of her species.
Much. She's even smarter than other queens. Yeah, she's smarter than the other queens, and they don't like it much. And that, too, is an element. I think that crops up mostly in the 4th book, where our characters actually encounter some other queens of that race and discover what she is and what she has done. And yeah, it's a mess. It's a mess. And that's one of the things I enjoy about it, is that there is none of the races, none of the people, there is no monolith here. It might look like that in the first book, and that's pretty standard. That's the way people think, it's the way people do things. And then as you learn more, you realize that's not how it is. That's not what it's really like. And I just really enjoy that in a storyteller. And of course, one of the reasons that I have drawn away from the Dresden Files book series is because there was a TV series for it on the Sci-Fi Channel way back in the early 2000s.
That's why I've heard about it.
Yes. In the beginning, the first, I don't know, 4 or 5 episodes I thought were quite good. The casting was amazing. They did a fantastic job casting Paul Blackthorne as Harry Dresden. That was my first exposure to him, and I thought he was absolutely excellent. And the farther the season went on, the less good it felt. Well, more correctly, the Dresden Files as a TV show is an excellent example of, if I hadn't known about the books, this would have been amazing. But because I knew it was based on these books and therefore had certain expectations, it was not as good as I wanted it to be.
So would you say watch the Dresden Files before you read the book so you can enjoy both?
I don't know, because I think to a certain extent, inevitably, you are going to make comparison. Inevitably, you are going to make, you're going to say, well, it was in this, but not in that. If you are the sort of person who can take them as 2 separate takes on the same concept, then you will enjoy both. If you're not that sort of person, and unfortunately, I'm often not, you're going to favor one over the other. And since I encountered the books first and I am a more book-oriented person, I favor the books. It's true that the series did an excellent job with some of the elements that were loved most from the books, but there are characterizations, there are relationships that they altered that I was not pleased with the change of, because I quite liked the way that they were in the books. And there is only the one season. And as with a lot of TV shows, especially sci-fi shows, and I don't know why this is the case, the channel that aired them made choices in the order of airing that can make it quite confusing if you actually don't have that initial basis. There was supposed to be a 2-hour introductory pilot episode that they did not show. The episode that they chose to premiere with was intended to be the 3rd episode, which implies that they're going to dump a lot of stuff on you and not have it be explained, because the explanations were supposed to come previously. And I do think that that is one of the reasons why it did not get a second season.
And that reminds me of the only thing about The Witcher that disappointed me. Because they were acting like I'm supposed to know all this shit.
It is one of the most difficult things to balance in any kind of speculative fiction work, whether you are writing a book or a movie or a TV series, is how much information do you give to the person who is consuming your media, and when do you give it? In some cases, the author chooses to give very little at all. There's a reason that many speculative fiction works involve as a main character either someone who was dropped in from another world or a very young person, because in both cases, the story itself gives you an excuse to explain things, because the person doesn't know. If they're quite young, then they're encountering these things for the first time, and therefore you can have explanations. If they're from outside the world, then they're encountering these things for the first time, and you can have explanations. You know, whereas if you're talking about someone, if you're talking about Jean-Luc Picard, who is of an age at the time we're at the introductory episode of Star Trek, you would expect him to know certain things, and therefore not need to explain them. That you don't need to provide an explanation to your lead character about what the Federation is and how starships work and what warp is for. You know? And yet the audience does not know these things, and you must find a way to get them this information.
I want to know the things, so I get a bit irritated when people review movies and TV shows and say, oh, this one had too much exposition. Sit down and enjoy the story that's being told to you. They don't have to be running around and fighting all the time. If you put a nice voice to tell me this exposition, I'll gladly listen to it.
You have put your finger directly into one of the most long-running, if somewhat polite, discussions in speculative fiction. This has been a discussion since ever. It has probably been a discussion since before Frankenstein, which is commonly held to be the first sci-fi book. It has been a thing since ever. How do you tell your listeners what they want to know? How do you make it so that the listeners who don't care don't get overwhelmed, but the ones that do get enough? And there is no good answer.
Choose your audience, I guess. But
it is partly
feel like
choose your audience. It is partly audience choose your writer. Because there are different writers who make different choices, and a person such as you and me who loves to have lots of the fascinating details will, for example, gravitate towards writers like Tolkien, who puts tons of that detail in there. Or, frankly,
but what about TV shows? No one's giving me the exposition I want in TV shows.
Sometimes they do. It really does depend on the show. At some point I need to go and watch the Wheel of Time show, which is supposed to be pretty good with that. There are shows that have done. I felt that Firefly did a pretty good job with that.
I haven't seen that. I have more to watch then.
Be prepared to be mildly disappointed at the end of the first season, because there isn't any more.
Okay. I remember that.
Firefly is the sci-fi community's favorite, one of our favorite flags to wave about how badly we get treated by big media. but that's a discussion for another time.
Joss Whedon.
Yes, that too is part of the flag and where things get complicated. And again, that's I could do a whole podcast episode on that shit, I promise. That's a whole thing I could do. But in short, I definitely, absolutely recommend Jim Butcher's Codex Alera, just because there's absolutely no doubt that he won that bet hands down. The Lost Roman Legion and the Zerg and Pokemon and assembled them into a fantastic story with brilliant world building and really good characters. And there are tropes all over the place, but you don't feel like your nose is rubbed in them. If you're interested in modern wizardry and Harry Potter didn't give you enough, I definitely recommend the Dresden Files. It can be a little dark at times, but that's kind of one of the strong elements of urban fantasy. And if you're tired of your urban fantasy being 50% romance, the Dresden Files will save you. Because it's very urban fantasy. It's not really much romance. Largely because Harry, in the first place, Harry doesn't do romance well. He's not that kind of person. He's just generally bad at it. And in the second place, because by the third book, I think, the Winter Queen of the Fae has an interest in him. And it's not entirely platonic. And how do you have a mortal girlfriend when the Winter Queen has a romantic interest in you? Oops. So, yeah. Yeah. And if you're into steampunk stuff, then I recommend The Cinder Spires, although it's clearly coming out quite slow. So we may not ever get to finish that one.
Jim's website says his resume includes a laundry list of skills which were useful a couple of centuries ago. And he plays guitar quite badly.
Yeah, that last line is a lie. He plays guitar reasonably well. He just has higher expectations than... But that's pretty normal for those of us, too. That's pretty normal for us sci-fi people, as we have. Also, be aware that Jim's son, who is also called James, also publishes. And so I think James's book came out recently. So you may discover books. Yeah. James has published two books.
James Butcher.
Who is, in fact, the son of Jim Butcher. I have not read any of James's books, but it would not surprise me to discover that they are quite good. But you should be aware that they are, in fact, two separate people. Jim and James are not the same person. They are father and son.
Jim currently resides mostly inside his own head.
Yeah.
His head can generally be found in the mountains outside of Denver, Colorado.
Yeah, that sounds... Yeah. Seems accurate. Seems accurate. Yeah.
Let's hope he doesn't forget his body somewhere else.
Well, I mean, I'm not going to have that discussion. But that's a pretty apt description of a lot of us speculative fiction people. The head is somewhere. What's inside it? Oh, we don't know. We could be anywhere. We could be anywhere.
Yeah.
So. I hope that...
Is that it from us?
I think so. I hope that all of our meowsters are bearing up well under the cold and the dim that is winter in the Northern Hemisphere. If you're in the Southern Hemisphere as a listener, then I hope you are enjoying your warm and your light. Please send some up here. It is very gray and I don't like it. Remember to listen to as much heavy metal as you want. To be aware of what kind of heavy metal you're listening to with your moods. To grow your hair as long as you like and take care of yourself.
Take your meds. Check on your friends.
Allow your friends to check on you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And thank you for listening. Bye, guys.
Bye, guys.